This is PCJ Radio International.
Shortwave listening, to many the final frontier. These are the voyages of PCJ Radio's Media Network Plus. Its continuing mission to track down strange news signals and to seek out news stations and radio personalities and to boldly go where many men have gone before.
I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to another edition of the monthly version of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We begin today to talk about the mind of an author. Now, sometimes people don't know how my own mind works, and I have to be honest with you, I don't know either. But imagine this, you're an author, you come out with a book, and then you think, well, I can write a second one because there's a lot of information that I didn't put in the first one. So you come out with a second one. And then a little time passes and you start writing a third one. And then you think, good, I have a trilogy, everything is done, no more, that's it, that's all. I can now move on to do something else. A couple of years ago, a guest that we had on the show did exactly that. His name is Jerry Berg, and he wrote three fascinating books on the history of international broadcasting. At the time of his third release, the third book, I asked him, well, is there any more in the pipeline? And he said, no, that's it. No more. Well, to my surprise, a few weeks ago, guess what? I received an email saying there is now a fourth book. So it's a continuing series of books that, well, were apparently supposed to end. His new book, also about international broadcasting, is a fascinating read. They actually all are. They're a very good source for data and information, because you don't have to go to a library or anything like that to collect it. So very good, actually. Very, very, very good. So, of course, we had to have him back. My first question to him is, what happened?
What happened was that the broadcasting book, let me describe that for a second. The book, one of the two books that came out in 2009, which was Broadcasting on the Shortwave, 1945 to today, that book covered shortwave broadcasting, covered the shortwave broadcasting stations in a chronological fashion, year by year. You could pick up the book and you could read what was happening in 1951, and then you could read what was happening in 1952 and so forth. So you had there a complete picture of the shortwave station scene as seen from the point of view of the listener from 1945 to the middle of 2008. And when I finished that, it occurred to me that if I could take the same approach for the years before 1945, you would have really a complete picture chronologically from the beginning of shortwave, which was actually before 1923, all the way up to the middle of 2008. And so I went back to the 1923-1945 period, which had been covered in the first book, and approached it strictly from the standpoint of the stations and strictly chronologically. The first book does have some information on stations in it, but the first book was a fairly broad treatment of shortwave. It was a little bit of everything, receivers, publications, clubs, all sorts of things, including stations. But the new book covers that period from the standpoint mainly of the stations. And again, like the broadcasting book, it's year by year. So if you have both books, you'll have a year by year chronology of shortwave broadcasting from the beginning up to the middle of 2008. So that's really what drew me to doing the fourth book. Plus, there's a lot of very interesting history back in those early years that I think really hadn't been explored very much. So it was a chance to do that.
How do you find this kind of information? Because quite often, for example, when people have written books about television, they, you know, from the early days of television, let's say with like the first BBC broadcast from the 1930s or John Logie Baird's mechanical television set from the 1920s, information is out there. But it's sort of scattered all over the place. They have to speak to people who are maybe still alive, who were young at the time, who knew what Baird was up to. I mean, with radio, what kind of work went into this? Were you just half the time pulling your hair out, saying, "Oh, what am I going to do? Where am I going to turn?"
Yeah, it's not the kind of subject where you can go to the library and look things up. I mean, there are some academic materials, don't get me wrong, that deal with various aspects of shortwave broadcasting. And if you sort of write long enough, you come across them in various ways. But those are really kind of the secondary materials that have gone into my books. I've been a collector of shortwave memorabilia from the beginning of shortwave. I've been doing this since the 1980s. And as a result, I have really a very large collection of materials that were produced throughout all of these years that I've been writing about. And so what I'm able to do is to go back to original materials from these early years and cull out the news and information from those items. If I didn't have that material, that original material, I don't think I could have ever done this.
Now, because of the other three books, when you were writing this one, was there anything that you came across that you were surprised about that you really never even had thought of before? You just didn't know.
Oh yeah. There are a lot of things that I came across. Mostly, the material in the new book, I hit most of it in the first book, but at a much higher level. This book is much more detailed. As I say, it covers the stations almost exclusively, whereas the first book covered many other subjects. As a result, the breadth and the depth of the new book is much greater than the first book. And in the course of writing the second book, I dug a lot deeper into a lot of subjects. And I learned some things that were new, and I kind of relearned things that I had known originally but hadn't been able to include in the book. Some of the more interesting things I learned about were shortwave broadcasting in the Spanish Civil War, which is really where the whole notion of shortwave as a propaganda medium took root. Now, I had always known that Latin American broadcasting flourished in the early days of shortwave, but as I was writing the second book, I came to appreciate how many shortwave stations came on the air from South America, largely as a result of the different kind of governmental controls over radio in South America. You really didn't have government stations down there. You had either amateur radio operators who branched off into broadcasting, or you had AM into shortwave broadcasting, or you had AM stations that set up shortwave operations. So there was a whole world of Latin American broadcasting that grew up in the 1930s and the early 1940s. And of course, the deeper you dig, the more you find out about things. The early life of the BBC is always an interesting subject matter, and how the BBC was sort of dragged kicking and screaming into the business of shortwave broadcasting. And it's ironic that was the case, because, of course, over the years, the BBC became, in many ways, the gold standard of shortwave broadcasting. But at the beginning, they were very, very reluctant to get into shortwave broadcasting. So there are a lot of things that I learned and relearned in the course of putting together this new book.
Something that I find interesting and also quite sad, because, I mean, technically, if you really wanted to write an entire encyclopedia about, you know, shortwave and international broadcasting, you can probably write one book on every major and medium-sized shortwave broadcaster out there. And what I've noticed, especially recently, you know, with the big budget cut that happened at Radio Netherlands. Radio Netherlands had a vast archive of recorded programs that went back to the 1940s. Some went back to the early days when it was Philips Radio, PCJJ. And because of their budget cut, they are now in the process of literally dumping and just getting rid of their entire recorded history, which is quite sad, because in 30 or 40 years from now, if somebody wanted to come along and find out what the station was doing, if they're still around, that information is just not going to be there. And so many stations I can think of had the same problem. When I was at Radio Havana, Cuba, one day they decided to throw away all the archive tapes that they had from the 1950s, from the 60s and the 70s, because they said, oh, we don't need it anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a problem that confronts all organizations, you know. As you need more space and you don't have the money to get more space, you look at stuff that you have and you try to figure out ways of opening up the space, and you wind up throwing things out. And while to, you know, devotees of shortwave, all that history is just priceless. You know, to somebody who has a job to do today, it's just a lot of boxes to get rid of. But that is a sad story. But you know, it's the way of the world with a lot of different things besides just broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were writing this book, what are the do you focus on specific areas of the world, or is it on early shortwave broadcasting worldwide?
It's worldwide. As you read each chapter, or each year, I should say, each part of the world is treated separately. So you might read under 1936, for example, you would read about all of the American activities in one place. You would read about all the Latin American activities in another place. You might read about all of the Asian activities in a third place, so that there's some geographical integrity to it. I think if you wrote it in a different way, I think it would just be too confusing if you were jumping from activities in Japan to activities in Bolivia to activities in Canada. So there is some geographical integrity to each year, although it's not necessarily it's the same from year to year. In 1936, you might start out reading about the U.S. at the beginning of the year, but in 1938, the year might start out with activities in Europe, sort of depending on what was happening in the world at that particular time.
Now, the first book, which covers the years 1923 to 1945, were there stations on the air before 1923?
Well, there were experimental operations. The reason I chose 1923 was because that was the year that KDKA, which was really, by my definition, the first shortwave broadcaster, that's the year that they regularized their shortwave transmissions. But they were actually on the air in test mode in 1922. Of course, there were medium wave stations on the air, standard broadcast stations on the air by that time as well. But KDKA, I view KDKA as the first. It was really in 1923 and after 1923 that things started picking up. And for the first few years after 1923, it was mostly American stations that were kind of following the KDKA example and simulcasting their broadcast band station on shortwave. Toward the latter part of the 1920s, other countries got into the act, primarily Holland, which was really the first station that offered what you could call a real international service, a service that was intended for direct-to-listener reception, as opposed to the relay of programs from one country to another for rebroadcasting in the receiving country on standard medium wave frequencies.
You know, it's amazing when you look back at around that period, and this is something I only found out recently, but back in the 1920s, in the United Kingdom, where John Logie Bird was doing a lot of television tests, he would get transmitter time from the BBC and mechanical television to send out the mechanical television signal. They would use two transmitters, one for the visual and then one for the audio. And his company, Bird Television, for a short period, even used shortwave to send out the video signal and the audio signal, and it was picked up as far away in New York City using mechanical TV sets in the United States. I mean, it is funny when you think about it. You know, television programs, a regular scheduled television program going out on shortwave.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's true. There were similar events when FM came in. You know, FM came in and. You would have thought that FM would have been widely received, but actually at the beginning, even after receivers became available, FM really wasn't very popular. But there were a lot of FM stations that were operating in the 20 and 30 megahertz band and didn't really expect to be heard very far at all, but actually they turned into a worldwide DX targets. This was in the late 30s and early 40s.
One final...
So-called apex band, it was called.
One final question before we go, and this is the same question I asked you in 2009. This is the fourth book before I said it was the third book. Is there another one on the horizon? Are we going to be, you know, speaking again in about 4 or 5 years because you've written another book?
A definitive no. I've retired from the business of writing shortwave books. I think I've pretty much covered what I want to cover, at least in terms of books. Now, I'm still doing research. I write articles. I post things on my website. And I'm still very active in that area. But I think this one is the last of the books, so it's no longer a trilogy. I don't know, what do you call it when there are four books? A quadrology?
Quadrology. Sure. would you be willing to put money on that?
I'll put 50 cents on it, Keith. What do you say?
Sounds good. Jerry Berg, thank you very much for joining us. The book is called The Early Shortwave Stations of Broadcasting History through 1945. Jerry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Keith. My pleasure.
If you want information on how to get the book, do write us an email, mnp@pcjmedia.com. I was speaking there with Jerry Berg, who's just written a fourth book on international shortwave broadcasting. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you on this great partner station from PCJ Radio International. Thank you. Being an investigative journalist is not easy. It's not like being a regular journalist where you work on one story a day. An investigative journalist could sometimes take a month, sometimes even longer, to get the information out. Our next guest is Kate McClaymont. Now, she's won a number of awards for her groundbreaking reporting on business, organized crime, and corruption, and also for getting herself into some sticky situations along the way. She speaks next to our friend Richard Ady, who first asked her, why did you decide to go into this?
Oh, apart from being fun. Oh, look, in fact, investigative journalism is really no different to normal journalism. The principles are just the same. The ethical considerations are just the same. It just requires a little bit more patience and more ferreting. I think it's the ferreting that perhaps separates it out from everyday journalism.
Bit more. How much more?
A lot more.
Not bit more at all.
No, well, it's that thing where you might make 100 calls for an investigation that you're working on, and of those 100, only 10 might be worthwhile. But you have to put in the hard work. And there are lots of rebuffs. You know, you might start off doing something that you think looks great, but down the track you realise that either you can't prove it, it's too defamatory, you are just not going to get over the line. So there are disappointments along the way.
So you know it going in, and yet it doesn't stop you. That must be, I suppose I want to drill down into the skills and characteristics. One of the characteristics must be that you're optimistic and resilient.
Completely optimistic. I always think that there's going to be something fabulous there, and often when I, you know, work with other people, oh, no, no. And I said, no, come on, come on. It's going to get there. It's going to get there. And the good thing about print is that you can nearly always get something in a story. You might not have the brilliant result that you were hoping for, but often you have enough to do a story or a series of stories. So it's never wasted. And also, I'm known in the offices as the queen of the files. So I have alphabetical files on everything.
What, you have meters of them?
Meters of them. In fact, when anyone leaves, the first thing I do is look left, look right. Is their cupboard empty? Yes.
Right.
So I colonise with my files.
Right. So your files have grown to move throughout the office.
Oh, yes. And I, the other thing that I am lucky in is that I have a very good memory for scraps of information. So if someone will come to me and say, do you know anything about Mr. X? I'll go, Mr. X, ha-ha, come with me. So over to the files we go, and there will be something. Not always. I have to say, with the electronic storing of things, it does make it so much easier to search your computer when you can just type in a name and up they pop.
One of the things you are renowned for is getting people to talk. And sometimes getting people to talk when it's not really in their interest to talk, Kate. How do you do that?
Look, I think it's a natural curiosity, and also I'm quite polite. I love talking to people. I'm interested in hearing what they say. And also, you know, I have human compassion. You know, sometimes I will say to people, look, you do realise this might be not good for you. It might not be something that you will desire. I always think it's best to often warn people, especially people who aren't experienced in dealing with the media. If you ring up, you know, somebody who's been a director of a small company, apart from when you say it's Kate McClaymont and you just hear this, you think, look, it's all right, it's all right. I'm only asking you about X, Y, Z. You know, you must try to, talk to people on a human level, not to be always blustering and, you know, hard-hitting. You can be. I can be very hard when I need to be, especially with politicians, when you know that they are lying to you. And I just say, look, what you are saying is not true. And it's interesting the reactions that you get, because I think everyone is the same. I remember once Paul Keating ringing up to abuse me, and I just thought, I'm not putting up with this. So I said, look, if you could read, I said, which I sincerely doubt you can, you would see that in this story I wrote blah, blah, blah. And I just think, treat everyone like as you would like to be treated, and treat everyone equally.
I want to get into the, I suppose, the genesis of how stories happen. But let's start with something bigger, because you've done so many great stories. Which one is the one you're proudest of?
A former partner of the now-defunct personal injury law firm Keddies has spoken for the first time about the overcharging scandal that engulfed the firm. The New South Wales-based company became infamous for its controversial billing. The firm is facing more than 70 separate court cases over allegations it overcharged former clients. In one case, a client claims he was charged $10,000 for photocopying.
Look, one of the ones I was really proud of was one that I did with my former colleague, Jenny Cook, on Keddies, the law firm. Mm. That actually took weeks, but we were able to reveal a systematic, basically shortchanging of clients. And these are poor, injured clients who spoke little English. And as a result of our work, the law was changed. Also, Keddies is no more. The three partners of Keddies, they're all bankrupted. Some of them have been struck off. So I think that was, you know, one of those ones you notch up to, you know, a win for the good guys. And I don't mean by that journalists. I mean, we're doing it on behalf of other people. You know, I often think that our job is giving a voice to the voiceless. So to see those clients get their money back, that the law was changed, you do feel like, you know, look, that was something really worthwhile. And of course, for me, the Eddie Obeid saga has been one of the longest running continual investigations of my life. I think my first investigative piece on Eddie Obeid ran in the year 2000.
Mm.
And throughout that time, apart from in 2006, my colleague Anne Davies and I were sued successfully by Eddie Obeid, and I have
for
to say...
For defamation, wasn't it?
That was for defamation, and Eddie Obeid won.
Mm.
And that was, I think, the lowest point of my journalistic career. I felt devastated, I felt like a failure, I felt that people would look at me and think, oh, you know, that person's not very good, you know, Eddie Obeid has sued her and won. And that lasted for... about a year, just in relation to my Obeid coverage.
So did you kind of leave him alone for a bit?
Yes.
Hmm.
Because you sort of feel that if you do write more stories, people will look at it as payback or vengeful, or that you haven't taken the umpire's decision. And then you think, no, if a story deserves to be told and there is something there, then... it's time to get back on the horse, really. Time to dust yourself off, pick yourself up, and get back on the trail.
If we talk about, carefully, obviously, if we talk about Mr. Obeid and ICAC, and the ICAC inquiry has almost certainly been precipitated by the reporting you did, especially with Linton Besser as well.
Yes, and can I also say my colleague Anne Davies, and also some really fantastic work from the reporters at the Australian Financial Review.
But was there a starting point? Was there a phone call, or was this part of the continued investigation of Mr. Obeid? What was it?
I saw in the court lists that Moses Obeid and his company Streetscape were being sued by the City of Sydney Council. So I went along to that court case. And in fact, it was that court case that provided a crack in the door to the Obeid empire, because Mr. Obeid, this is Moses Obeid, was being prosecuted for not paying royalties he owed to the council. And they're over multifunction poles you'll see along the streets of, you know, mainly in Sydney. They're large poles that have banners on them.
Mm.
They have lights, banners, traffic lights.
And yes. You really notice them when there's a special occasion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they had the license to produce these poles in Australia. They did not have the overseas licenses, except for, you know, one or two special circumstances. So what happened was that the council noticed that they were producing these poles all throughout the Middle East. And in fact, they owed the council some $12 million in licensing fees. So that was quite a protracted court case. But the nub of it for me was that when Moses Obeid said he couldn't pay, he produced financial statements which showed that his income was $100,000 a year, his wife was $80,000, the home wasn't in his name, etc., etc. These were tendered as exhibits, and there were other, his accountants tendered material as well. So I put in to look at these documents, and the Obeids objected. So I had to represent myself in court before the Supreme Court, saying that, you know, in the principle of open justice, it was important that public exhibits that had been tendered should be freely available. What I got was extraordinary, because there were in the accounts monies going to, for example, the cafes down at Circular Quay. Now, for years, we had been of the belief that the Obeids secretly owned a string of cafes at Circular Quay, but questions put to the proprietors always said no, even though we knew that they were relatives of the Obeids. There was also money going to some of the very people who had won coal licences from Ian MacDonald.
So that was... It was like a Pandora's box.
It was like a Pandora's box. So finally, the links that had been missing for us were there in financial documents relating to, of all things, a poll case.
So from the Obeid point of view, the tendering of those documents on Moses Obeid's behalf to prove he couldn't pay has turned into a massive strategic blunder.
Well, yes. And it was fascinating because Justice Peter Young, you know, in the Supreme Court, actually said that looking at these documents reminded him of a chapter from William Thackeray's Vanity Fair, which was How to Live Well on Nothing a Year.
Yes.
Because it turned out that Moses Obeid and his wife lived in a $4.25 million house in, I think, what Justice Young described as a most superior suburb, that being Vaucluse. They also drove his and her Range Rovers. I think that their outgoings for the year were about $800,000. Their mortgage payments were something like $240,000, and yet their combined incomes were $180,000. How was all this possible?
Lucky at the track.
Lucky at the track. But as it turned out, there were a series of Obeid trusts, and through these trusts were flowing millions and millions of dollars. Where did these millions of dollars come from? Their success at the coal mining, getting coal mining license.
So did you get this, when you got the documents, straight away, did you know?
Yes,
this was
absolutely.
It. This,
yes.
This is going to crack the whole thing.
Well, not that this is going to crack the, not, look, you sort of could sense that, but it was just seeing these names, you thought, oh my goodness, here it is. Here is, you know, so, the golden arc.
So did you go and make copies and put them somewhere else and things like that, or?
No, I just photocopied them, ran up a little bit of a bill for the Herald, and then, you know, ran back to work saying, hallelujah.
So how often does it come down to the document? Because the document's always, if X tells Y about Z, whether it's literally a bit of paper or an email, then you have got something, haven't you?
Yes. Look, when you do a story, in the back of your mind is always, how am I going to prove this in court? So getting anything in documentary form, of course, is always a bonanza. If you don't get it in documentary form, you have to weigh up your sources, whether they would be credible in a witness box, whether they would be prepared to go in a witness box. You know, there have been occasions when I've had neither of those. When I got the story about Michael Williamson and Craig Thompson of the Health Services Union having American Express cards provided to them by a major contractor to the union, I went into the Herald, I explained the story, and they said, no documents. And I said, I'm telling you, I've got the source. Who is the source? I said, I can't tell you. It's a good source.
Is this the editor or is this the lawyer?
Well, this was initially the editor. Then there was a meeting with the editor, the editor-in-chief, two lawyers, the managing editor and me.
Right.
And I had to convince
them. They were on one side of the table, yes. And you were on the other one.
It was like doing an audition for something. So I gave, you know, what was a fairly impassioned speech, and I said, look, I'm just telling you, you have to trust me on this. And Peter Frey, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, said, oh, I can see a $200,000 lawsuit. And it was Amanda Wilson, who was the editor at the time, you know, looked at me, looked down, and said, right, we're going with it. I believe you. We're going to go with it. And that was trust. It was, I think, if you have enough runs on the board.
Yeah, a track record too.
Yeah, it's a track record.
I went in and said, look, I've got this yarn.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, Richard, I don't know. You could be fairly persuasive.
Have there been moments when you have been sufficiently annoying to people of power that you have been threatened?
Threatened? Look, I can remember once ringing Eddie Obeid for a comment about a certain story, and he just lost the plot and said, I will go for you. I will go for your jugular. You write one word of that story and I will go for you. Now, I take that as being something said in the heat of the moment. I don't literally think that the Obeids would go for my jugular. Having said that, I did find it quite disconcerting when earlier this year a private investigator rang me and said, look, I actually think you should know this, but Moses Obeid came to me to hire me to follow you, to try to find something in your life that they could use to blackmail you. And at first I laughed. I just thought, oh, my God, my life they would find so boring. Work home, play bridge, work home. And then I felt really annoyed. So, and I just thought, well, okay, I must be doing my job well if that's what they were prepared to do.
So you've never felt, not particularly in that instance, but at any instance, you've never felt intimidated or thought, actually, I might stop?
No.
Because there have been times when you've had to move, you've hired security, haven't you?
Both of those. And in the wake of the murder of Sydney businessman Michael McGirt back in 2009, within several days of his murder and writing about that story, I received a death threat delivered to my house, which I took to the police.
What was it? A piece of paper?
It was a piece of paper.
Not a horse's head.
No, no, sadly, not a horse's head. It was a piece of paper, and it basically had a reference to a .303 rifle, and if I kept going, then maybe I would find out what a .303 rifle could do. But people do that because they want you to stop what you are doing. I think it would be really bad for business if they actually carried it out. So, no, look, I'm optimistic, and it's not nice, and I worry about my family. I don't worry about myself so much, but I do sometimes worry about possibly putting them in danger.
Michael McGurk was shot in the head as he got out of his car in front of his Cremorne home last night. His 9-year-old son saw the shooting and ran inside screaming to his mother. Last week, McGurk called a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald and told her a hitman had been ordered to kill him. His mother-in-law, Noreen MacDonald, says she...
There have been some remarkable sort of scenes. One day your life's going to be filmed or made into a kind of movie, Kate, I think. But when Michael McGurk was killed, the really amazing thing was that a week before he was killed, he told you he thought he was going to be killed.
Yes, look, and I feel really bad about that to this day, because I had met Michael McGurk a couple of times. My then colleague Vanda Carson and I had had lunch with him, and he was in the middle of this, you know, enormous dispute with the man who's now been charged with his murder, a property developer, Ron Medich. And he kept saying, you know, I've got all this dirt on Ron Medich, forget about me, because he had been charged with the firebombing of a house at the time.
He was no angel, was he?
No, certainly not. And he kept saying he had this tape. This tape, it's going to bring down the government. I've got this tape. And finally, I snapped at him and I said, oh, look, stop telling me about the tape and just give me the tape. You know, I can't do anything, you know, without the tape. You're saying that there's this tape. And he said, you don't understand. There's a hit out on me. I'm going to be murdered. And I didn't say anything at the time, but I hung up the phone. I thought, oh, honestly, these people exaggerate, really.
Because that was my next question. Did you believe him? Did you think drama queen? Or did you think he is trying to manipulate me?
Because I thought he was trying to manipulate me, and I thought he was being a drama queen. And then when it actually did happen, I felt a sense of complete remorse and, you know, could I have done anything? I don't think so. But I did speak to the police that night. So within an hour or so of him being murdered, someone had got in touch with me to say that this had happened. So I did pass on, you know, what I knew, because at the same time, we're citizens. We have rights and obligations. Not everything is a story. And I think sometimes journalists get lost in that a little bit.
How has the job changed, Kate? Because you've been doing it a long time.
Look, I think the job has changed in that the access to information now is certainly so much easier. One of the tools most often used by investigative journalism is the Australian Securities and Investments Commission records. These are records that show who was in a company, who their business partners are, what previous businesses they might have had, are they bankrupt, what charges are on their property, meaning have they got large borrowings with banks, etc.
It's good stuff, in other
words. It's great stuff. 20 years ago, you had to go down in person, and it was then the Australian Securities Commission, and you couldn't put in Richard Adey. I couldn't put your name in and say, tell me what you've got. I had to know the names of your companies before I could search them. And I remember doing a story on a corrupt union boss, even back then. And the biggest joy in his life was his greyhounds. So I got a list of his greyhounds from the Greyhound Racing Authority.
Was that difficult, actually?
Or well, it was.
So you had to get those first.
Off I trot, and there were the greyhounds. They were the names of his company. So I did a little jig in the foyer of the Securities Commission. But now you can sit at your desk and you can do these things. They are costly, and I think that makes investigative journalism almost impossible for others other than those employed by the large organisations. One, doing those kind of searches with ASIC, as I said, are not cheap. We also do real estate data checks. We also have, you know, resources to lawyers. Sometimes during an investigation, I will ring up our lawyers and just run something past them saying, right, if we continue going down this track, do you think it'll be a defamation problem if we pursue this angle or that angle? And then if things do go wrong, you have a major organisation there to support you. I mean, when I say do go wrong, it's more dealing with complaints that come in. People still try to threaten you. Once you write a story, you'll often get a letter saying, you write one more story on this and we will prosecute you not just for defamation but for malice, that you're showing a pattern of going after our client. And those kind of things are intimidating in their own way.
Mm. You're saying, you know, you only can do that because you have the freedom of working at a large organisation. It's a smaller organisation than it was. There's been cutbacks at the Herald and at Fairfax and indeed at all newspapers. And you're hardly resourced like Woodward and Bernstein were, or the heyday of the Sunday Times Insight team. Has that made it harder at all?
I think what has made it harder is that there's just not enough of us to do the stories that are there to be done. For instance, I spend quite a bit of my day replying to emails. People call, you know, please, you know, you're my last resort. Can you look at X, Y, Z? And it's heartbreaking saying to these people, look, I'm dreadfully sorry, but I just can't. And a lot of time goes through sifting through all these things that come in.
So how many more of you could you do with?
Oh,
Or other, because we've mentioned other fine investigative journalists who you've worked with, but obviously the teams that do this
in all of our papers are smaller. I don't think that I have any particular gift. It's not that. It's just that over the years, I think you build up really good contacts who are always helpful. And I must emphasise that you have to behave ethically. There's this thing called burning a source where if you get a great story that you've given your word that you won't print, if the story is big enough, then, you know, people say burn your source. To me, that is a complete anathema, because I just sort of feel you are as good as your word. And there have been times in the past where I've had a great story and I've gone back to my source and said, please, will you let me use it? And they've said no. And I've stuck to that. And I just sort of think you do need to have a reputation that people can trust you, that if you are called before a court and they ask you to name your source, you will respect the undertaking that you have given.
Would it be possible now for you to spend a month on something and not have anything at the end of it, not have something in the paper? Would that be okay now?
Yes. Look, that does happen, but you tend to be self-regulating because journalists are such fragile creatures. If I haven't had something in the paper for 2 weeks and someone says to me, oh, have you been on holidays? I feel crushed. I feel a failure. I feel, oh. So you do make a call. If you don't think that something is going to develop, you might put it on hold.
Award-winning Australian investigative journalist Kate McClaymont speaking with Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. From time to time, we'd like to talk about receivers that are on the market. Now, a few weeks ago, I was turned on to a receiver from our good friend Victor Gunatelica, who just happens to be, by the way, PCJ Radio's frequency manager. The radio is called a Perseus. Now, it's not a regular radio. You have one at home, of course, but you can also tune in to other Perseus receivers around the world using the internet. It's absolutely fantastic, and I'm hooked. And I think Victor has just made me go and dish out a few $100 to buy one of them, because they're absolutely fantastic. He now joins us on the program to talk about the difference between the Perseus and a regular receiver.
Well, it's a new design. If you think of the traditional radio, it's a software-defined radio, so that the whole thing is in a little box, like the good old TNCs or router-sized thing, which you feed into the computer, and you see your receiver on your computer screen, and you control and do everything from your computer. So in that respect, it's quite different from a traditional radio, but you hear, you see exactly what you'll see in front of you if you are using another radio. Only thing is, the features, all those things are on your computer screen, and without a tuning knob, you can tune the frequencies up and down, go up and down with the mouse, or with the up and down keys of your keyboard or the computer. So everything is controlled with your computer, and even a recording program which you have on your computer can easily record anything, and no wires connecting and all that, and you'll have a one-to-one clear recording. So it's new technology, but you hear the same thing that you heard right over the years on your traditional communication receiver.
Now, here's a question that I can think that some people are asking right now who are not familiar with it, because we all know that computers can generate a lot of noise that you can hear on shortwave if you have a shortwave receiver that's too close to a computer. What about with Perseus?
Well, I haven't had any problem about the computer interfering, say, like noise or crackle and things like that, or a constant rumble or a hum. Of course, if you use an external hard drive, it tends to create a problem. So, but basically, I haven't had any problem with the Perseus. I'm using a Macintosh, of course. At the same time, we have a second Perseus, which is on a very simple, fairly old microprocessor type of thing, and this is a PC. So PC, I have no problem. Mac, no problem. So I don't think it's a problem at all for noise generated from your computer.
Now, what is the sensitivity like? Because the Perseus is not cheap. When I was looking around online, I saw secondhand ones for between $300 and $400, and new ones that were starting at $700 all the way up to $900, depending on the retailer. So what is sensitivity like?
I find the sensitivity on par with any other communication receiver I have. I have a Drake R8, I have an ICOM R71, I have the old, good, sturdy old valve type radio and simple Sony ICF 2010 or the 901 and the Texan. Absolutely nothing to complain. And in fact, leaving all these receivers aside, I tend to use the Perseus almost 100%, other than for my traditional monitoring, which is on a simple radio, naturally, what simple people would hear if they tune to RPCJ or Happy Station.
Now, let's talk about the Perseus itself. So what you're saying is you connect an antenna to this little box that looks like an old-style 14-4 modem. Then
yes.
It connects up to the computer, and you run the software, and that's it. Now, the unit itself, it's capable of picking almost every part of the broadcast dial. What about DRM?
Yes. Now, DRM, at the moment, the Perseus model that is on the market has DRM capability, but you have to have the software separately installed on your computer. Now, I'm using the very popular Dream software for DRM, and on my Perseus, I tune to the DRM signal. There's a separate button, like for instance, USB or SSB CW. Similarly, there is a button you click for DRM, and you click in, you bring in your Dream software, and you have your DRM signal. I understand a new model is to be introduced sometime later this year. Of course, this is I cannot confirm it, where Perseus manufacturer intends to incorporate a DRM software within the Perseus, and this will enable us, even on a remote receiver, on a remote Perseus, to listen to DRM. At the moment, it is not very easy to pick up DRM on a remote Perseus receiver because the software is separately installed on your computer.
One of the things that I enjoy actually about it, I mean, I've only been using it, the software, for about 2 weeks, which, by the way, I think you've just made me want to spend a whole lot of money to actually get a Perseus myself. It would be interesting to have one here, you know, operating out of Taiwan. But one of the things that I enjoyed about it is that it is actually incredibly easy to use. To connect to a different Perseus, you click one button and then you click another button, and it can open up a map and it shows all the Perseus units that are in use all around the world. So, for example, for Germany, you see Germany and then you see one, but then you zoom in to Germany and then you see others popping up.
Yes. I think at any given time, my experience has been that there are about 40 to 60 Perseus receivers online, and you can see them where they are spread out on your map that comes up on your computer. So all you got to do is to click with your mouse on any one of those that you select, and you bring it in. And just as you say, just click twice and another button and you are there. And the great thing is, if you are a city dweller plagued with noise, or even if you don't have your shortwave radio, for 60 days, if you download the software, you can have access to any receiver that's online and receive your favorite shortwave signals, whether it's just SWLing or DXing. Now, I have people tuning into my Perseus almost back-to-back, hardly any time that it's free. People from the US and from Australia, you name it, they come in. All you got to do is to have an internet connection, and you log into my Perseus or any other one, and you have absolutely free of charge the possibility of traveling to another location virtually and listening in. And, you know, one thing I love about the Perseus network is when PCJ, our Happy Station, goes on the air on Sundays, 13:30 to 14:30, while the program is going on, I'm clicking on various Perseus receivers all over the world to see how our signal is being picked up.
Well, this leads me to a question, Victor. Is Perseus something that, let's say, other international broadcasters use to monitor how their signals sound in various parts of the world? I mean, is it being used for that purpose?
Well, it is being used, but I don't know whether it's being used, very honestly, I don't know whether it's being used widely, because at the same time, I must mention the remote monitoring system of the IBB, the VOA, where my boss, Bill Whitaker, runs it, and it is open to anybody, broadcasters, to schedule their time slots and listen. So a lot of engineers do use that, and sometimes they schedule a weekly schedule of 15 minutes a day, every hour, and IBB. If you go to the IBB homepage, monitoring homepage, you'll see the whole thing there. So the Perseus, yes, people are starting to use it more and more, professional people in broadcasting, as well as the old and still functioning very well IBB system.
Our good friend Victor Gunatetica talking about the Perseus receiver, and I'm sure that we're going to do another program on that very soon. Well, it's now time to go to our propagation, and what we can expect over the next 7 days, as many international broadcasters will be changing frequencies very soon. Here's our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from October 26th to November 1st, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 115 on October 26th, October 27th and 28th, 110, 105 on October 29th, 100 October 30th and 31st, November 1st, 105. The A index is 5, steady all week long from October 26th to November 1st, and then a stable KP index at 2 from October 26th to November 1st. As the sun continues to be active this week, we hear a lot of noise on the bands. October 22nd brought us a solar tsunami and strong radio burst. The sun is peppered with sunspots 1872 through 1879. 1878 is not seen at this time. No coronal holes this week. We have more radio propagation for you at our website, www.pcjmedia.com/RPROP. Back to you, Keith.
Thanks, Dan. And with that, we conclude this edition of the monthly version of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can also catch the weekly version on the World Radio Network and through partner stations everywhere. Of course, that show is weekly and only 30 minutes. But you can also listen to it by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. So on behalf of Victor Gunatelica, Richard Adie, and everyone else who joined us on the program, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. Thanks so long, take care. 73 and 88 to the ladies.